It's a real pleasure to be able to address you all, and especially given the sunny day today. I was a little worried that maybe we'd have another storm. So what I'm going to present to you today is a small piece of a larger research project in which I'm investigating the causes of great changes in moral beliefs held by entire societies, and how we can improve our moral beliefs over time. My central case study concerns the abolition of slavery. About 300 years ago, there were very few, only isolated individuals, who believed that slavery was morally wrong. And now it's a nearly universal belief that it is morally wrong. So this is a really profound change in moral beliefs. And what I'm investigating is, first of all, how can we know that this is progress without begging the question in favor of our current beliefs? And secondly, can we get a grip on how moral progress, progress in moral thinking, can be achieved? And so today's lecture is going to give you just a small piece of that story, although I'm going to put it into a larger framework. We'll start off looking at the case of William Henry Brisbane. He was a Baptist minister and a slaveholder in South Carolina. He was the editor of a pro-slavery magazine called the Southern Baptist and General Intelligencer, in which he composed innumerable articles defending slavery and published other articles by other authors. However, Brisbane did have a moral conscience, and he wasn't quite sure whether all of his arguments were correct. The difficulty was that down south, it was very difficult to get access to abolitionist literature. The southern post offices refused to deliver it. It was actually prohibited. Censorship was universal in the south. People who tried to sneak in abolitionist literature would get beaten up or even lynched. And so he thought, well, maybe I should go north and study the arguments up north. So he went to Cincinnati, and he picked up Theodore Weld's classic abolitionist text, The Biblical Argument Against Slavery. And he was so infuriated by what he read that just from reading the preface, he sat down and he wrote 6 pages of detailed refutation of every last claim just in the preface. And by the end of it, he was completely convinced that abolitionism was right. Now imagine, like, any academic, right, this is our dream, right? Our enemy, right, starts reading our stuff, infuriated, and tries to refute it and comes out convinced. So he became a pretty famous abolitionist himself and wrote his own text, Slave Holding Examined in Light of the Holy Bible, and became a pretty popular abolitionist on the lecture circuit up north. So this might seem to be a triumph of moral reasoning. He read the arguments, and he was convinced. He was converted exactly the way the abolitionists hoped. But I've actually cracked open his book. And there's a problem with his argument. At the time, remember the 19th century, most everyone was a Christian and believed in biblical morality. It turned out, though, that biblical arguments were the strong suit of the pro-slavery side. And in fact, we have very detailed accounts of every last passage, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, showing that God sanctioned slavery, he provided laws for slavery, he rewarded his favorites with slaves. And then in the New Testament, we have Paul and others telling slaves to obey their masters. It doesn't actually look like the Bible has much of a moral problem with slavery. And so Brisbane, in order to get around this difficulty, decided he had to distinguish between slavery as it existed in the Bible and slavery as it existed in the South. And essentially what he said was, slavery in ancient Roman times, or in the times of the Pharaoh or whatever, that was just lifelong bonded labor. Okay, you're bound to your master, you have to serve him for life, no wages or anything like that. But that's not slavery. Okay, well, slave on his accounting had to be someone who, in addition to being bound for life to labor for a master, was someone who would have no recourse, no legal recourse or redress if his rights were abused. Now, it's quite a stretch if you go back to Roman times and thinking that slaves at that time had legal recourse. So we have some difficulties here. There's a further difficulty which I think is even more important, and that is, if your abolitionism only goes so far as to provide legal redress but has no problems with lifelong bonded labor, what kind of emancipation is that going to really deliver to the slaves? I think this raises some interesting questions of moral epistemology. One thing we can ask is a priori reasoning among elites, like Brisbane, sufficient to arrive at sound moral conclusions concerning the distinction between slavery and free labor? As we'll see, and it's a deep theme of the talk, is that the abolitionists hated slavery, but in fact they weren't too clear on what freedom, the freedom of the free laborer, really consisted in, or what it ought to consist in. The second question we can ask is, how would moral beliefs change if the slaves or the freed people got to participate in shaping moral beliefs? And that's what we're going to be looking at today. The critical point that we have to keep in mind is that when one defines slavery as the thing one opposes, once you give a definition of it, you are in essence also defining the freedom that will be achieved upon abolition. But this is a point hotly contested in all post-emancipation regimes. The background framework of moral epistemology that I'm going to be using in this talk is John Dewey's, his Pragmatism. Here we have a lovely shot of Dewey at my university when he was young. He was later became more famous at Chicago and Columbia. And let me just explain what pragmatism is, because it's a kind of vague term. People don't really know what it is. I'll give you a very succinct account of what pragmatism is in respect of moral philosophy. The basic idea is we are no longer going to search for a fundamental principle of morality that explains everything. Forget about the principle of utility or the categorical imperative or the golden rule. We can't get there. Instead of seeking a fundamental principle of morality or right and wrong that explains everything else, we will replace that quest with the quest for methods of intelligent updating of whatever moral beliefs we have at the moment. Okay? And that's really the key. We're going to replace the quest for foundations of moral thinking with methods of intelligently updating the beliefs that we already have about morality. And there are two basic ways to do that on Dewey's account. Well, this is my reading of Dewey at any rate. One is, we have to recognize that moral thought and all kinds of thought is riddled with all kinds of biases. So we have to develop techniques for counteracting those biases. And Dewey thought, in particular, the most important way to do that is to enlist everyone's participation, because everyone is biased in a somewhat different way. Nobody has a perfect mind, but if we get more people involved in shaping our moral beliefs, then other people can check the biases. We can check each other's biases in a way, and that could help us get better knowledge. And that's achieved mainly through processes of contestation, right? another person does not share the same belief as you, thinks that you're wrong, and will contest your belief. Sometimes in pure moral arguments, like around the seminar table, but sometimes out in the world, they might go on strike or demonstration, things like that. The second basic pragmatist idea for how to update our moral beliefs intelligently is we experiment. We test our moral norms through experiments in living. So a deep theme of Deweyan pragmatism is that moral reasoning is of a piece with scientific reasoning, which is of a piece with ordinary, everyday cognition. We're constantly coming up with ideas, putting them into practice, and seeing whether we can live with the results. How do we actually do that in the case of moral norms? Well, the first step is to interpret moral norms, practical norms, as attempting to solve certain problems. Okay, we interpret them as attempted solutions to problems. We put them into practice and see whether they solve the problems that they claim to solve with acceptable side effects. Now, here's a twist. You might think that pragmatism so described is purely instrumental reasoning, but that's not quite true. Because as we are putting our moral beliefs into practice, as we encounter one problem after another, we keep on reshaping our ideals. We keep on reshaping our conception of the problem that we have to solve. And so consequently, we're always working with something of a moving target here, and that's why it's not just purely instrumental reasoning. So now let's apply pragmatism to the question of slavery. In the United States, in the South, what was the problem that pro-slavery thinkers thought slavery was needed to solve? And this can be generalized, in fact, because slavery, of course, was practiced across the New World. So what was the problem that the defenders and institutors of slavery, including England and France, what problem did they think slavery was solving? How did the practical norm of forced labor solve something? Okay, and in fact, pro-slavery writers gave us an answer. The problem that they wanted to solve was the problem of civilization. Okay, what's the problem of civilization? First, let's get a definition of civilization on the table. A civilization is a form of society with an advanced division of labor. Okay, we're beyond hunter-gathering, we're beyond pure subsistence living. Civilizations have things like governments, navies, educational institutions, scientific institutions, churches, art, manufacturers, trade, commerce, right? We have an advanced and complex division of labor. That's what's needed for civilization. That is what civilization is. We have achieved life beyond mere subsistence. The problem of civilization is, how can we achieve, what kind of organization of labor is needed to achieve civilization? And the problem can be defined in terms of, any of you might be familiar with this, this is a labor supply curve. Any of you have taken introduction to microeconomics? The basic idea here is that, today economists assume that the more hours you, that the higher the wage rate, the more hours people are willing to work. But that was not what was assumed at the time. What was assumed at the time was that, yes, people will work more as the wage rate rises until they hit subsistence. But the moment farmers grow enough to feed themselves and their own families, they'll quit. Why work more? Working is hard. It's grueling. This was almost universally assumed. And so the difficulty was you can't induce more labor by raising the wage rate beyond subsistence. Because if you do that, then they'll just work less because they could make subsistence with fewer labor hours. So if you think that the average person's supply curve of labor looks like this, then how are you going to get civilization, which requires production of a surplus of food more than what the farmers need to feed themselves? Because you have to feed all these people who are in manufacturing and commerce and arts and science and so forth. They need food too, right? You have to get the farmers to produce more food than they need to survive themselves. If this story is true, the only way you can induce that labor is by force. And indeed, forced labor was pretty much the rule everywhere in the world before the mid-18th century. Okay, even at the mid-18th century, about 95% of the world labor force labored under some form of involuntary servitude. Of course, slavery was the worst form of that, but all kinds of others. You had serfs, indentured servants, apprentices, who were basically forced, debt peons. The destitute were forced into poorhouses and worked there. Sailors were impressed. You know where the British Navy got its sailors? From weddings. They'd send, it was a very dangerous thing to get married in a port city in England. Because, well, the thing about a wedding ceremony is there'd be a lot of young, healthy men. The groom and the groomsmen would be there. And so the ships would come in, burly guys, the press gang would crash the wedding, kidnap the groom and the best man, everyone, and put him on the ship. No wedding night for him. Okay, that was impressed. And penal servitude, of course, that's the great 13th Amendment exception that exists to this day. Forced labor is still constitutional if it's upon conviction for a felony. Now, of course, slavery is worse than forced labor. It's very important to keep in mind how much worse it was than ordinary forms of forced labor. Four basic ways in which it was worse. One is, of course, the pervasive violence of a very extreme sort. Violence was all over the place against all kinds of forced laborers, but slaves had it the worst. Secondly, of course, slaves were literally, legally, the property of another person. And a direct consequence of that was that slaves did not have a right to their own families. Right here we have a slave auction, right? The mother's being sold, auctioned off apart from the daughter, perhaps never to see each other again. No other form of involuntary servant lacked rights to family members, that is, rights to live with and see and continue have continued relationships with wives, parents, children, and so forth. And the fourth disability attached specifically to slavery is a condition that was known as civil slavery. Okay? And that meant that the slaves had no rights to property, contract, legal redress, right? Their testimony was not accepted in a court of law against a white person. They couldn't testify in court against anyone who had beaten them up. Now, there are some exceptions to this. If they themselves were put on trial, they were entitled to testify in their own defense. But they couldn't testify against a white person who had done something horrible to them. So we could then define a kind of minimal abolitionism as simply abolishing these four features of slavery, but tolerating oppressive servitude affected by contract. And indeed, Brisbane's work seems to fit into this mold, since he accepted that it would be okay for a person to sign a contract of lifelong servitude to a master. But it would still be a contract, so they, you know, would not be civil slaves. Okay, this would be affected by contract. But still, Brisbane was willing to tolerate pretty oppressive forms of labor. It just wouldn't literally be slavery, because these four features of slavery would be abolished. So let's go back and think again about pragmatism. Remember, we have two ideas here. One is we explore the problem that the norm is supposed to solve and test alternative solutions. And the second idea of pragmatism is to mobilize the excluded to counter the biases that are embodied in the solutions enforced by the powerful. Okay, so what are these biases? I'm going to borrow a leaf from feminist theory and a particular definition of objectification offered by Sally Haslanger. She has a wonderful, succinct definition of objectification, which goes like this. To objectify a group of people is, number one, to view that group in terms of its service to one's own desires. Secondly, to enforce that view of the group by placing that group in a subordinate role where their job is basically to serve one's desires. And thirdly, to represent the group as inherently fit for that role and unfit for superior roles. Okay, you put those three things together and you get the objectification of a group. Step three is known in contemporary psychology as the fundamental attribution error. That is, you see someone behave in a certain way and you assume they're behaving that way because of their intrinsic nature rather than because of the circumstances in which they have been placed. So let's see how the objectification bias worked in the case of chattel slavery of Africans. Okay, so here we're looking at white racial objectification of blacks in the slave era. Firstly, white defenders of slavery viewed blacks as good for menial labor and cash crops. That's basically what they were used for overwhelmingly, not just in the United States, but in the other countries that practiced slavery, Spain, England, France. Slave labor was overwhelmingly dedicated to the production of tropical and subtropical cash crops, sugar, coffee, tobacco, cotton, rice, things like that. Slavery, of course, was the way they enforced that view on blacks. And then they represented blacks as inherently fit for slavery and unfit for freedom. So let's see how that worked in a particular case. I'll take the pro-slavery tract of Thomas Dew, who is the president of the College of William and Mary. It's a very characteristic quote. I've read many pro-slavery tracts. They're basically all saying the same things. But this is what Dew said, that Negroes are not actuated by that principle which inclines more civilized men to work after the necessaries of the day have been procured. Their industry and their freedom are entirely incompatible. Here, he's just expressing the problem of civilization here. He's assuming that blacks will quit as soon as they reach subsistence. Okay? So they won't be able to, they won't be useful for creating civilization unless you force them to work. Okay? And that was the basic pro-slavery argument. There were others, there were biblical arguments and so forth. But this was a really critical argument. At this point, I'll introduce one of the great heroes of political economy arguments against slavery, namely Adam Smith. He was the originator of the most important political economy-based argument against slavery. Okay, in The Wealth of Nations, He argued very famously that the liberal reward of labor increases the industry of the common people. In intro microeconomic terms, he's articulating here the thesis of the forward-bending supply of labor. And at the time, this was considered a stunning idea. This is what made the Wealth of Nations famous, his argument for high and rising wages as a basis for increasing the prosperity of societies. But what about those slaves? The slave owners said, we can't get the slaves to work unless we whip them. And Smith had an answer. Well, the reason why the masters have to whip the slaves in order to get them to work is because they refuse to offer them any basis for improving their status. No matter how hard they work, they're never going to be given anything more than subsistence. So why should they work harder if you're not going to give them opportunities to improve their condition through work? So here, Smith here is basically accusing the pro-slavery people of the fundamental attribution error in contemporary psychology lingo, right? That they're mistakenly attributing to the slaves an innate disposition to laziness and sloth, when in fact the reason why they're not working so hard unless you force them is because you're not paying them, right? You're not giving them any opportunities to improve their condition. Thirdly, Smith argued very famously that free labor was more productive than slave labor. Just pay the workers and they'll produce even more. So in effect, right, this is the familiar supply curve of labor. This is Smith's idea. And basically everything to the right of the supply curve of labor, of course, can only be extracted by force. If this is a subsistence level here, the slavery point is actually a little bit below subsistence. I'll explain later why that's so. So basically everything here is what we call the force region, right? You can't get people voluntarily to put out this many hours worked at such a low compensation, okay? But Smith's solution is, look, you just pay them more and then you can get more effort out of them, more effort than what slavery was actually getting out of them. Well, as it turns out, Smith's theory was explicitly believed to be something that could be experimentally tested. And there were abolition experiments that took place explicitly in an experimental frame of mind, particularly in Jamaica, where upon the abolition of slavery by Britain in 1833, the bill for the abolition of slavery was actually introduced and defended as a mighty experiment in free labor, right? The experiment is to test whether the slaves actually would be industrious and promote civilization under wage labor without the whip. Haiti, of course, had the site of the only successful slave revolt in world history, and the slaves had liberated themselves in a great war between 1794 and finally solidifying their freedom in 1804. But for our purposes, we're going to be focusing mostly on experiments that took place during the Civil War in the American South. So what was happening, while the war was taking place, the Union Army had managed to occupy various parts of the Confederacy, including Port Royal, South Carolina. That's where William Brisbane had his slaves. And then along the Mississippi River here, the Union Army had conquered the Mississippi River. And so in Helena, Davis Bend, and Natchez, these were sites of other famous free labor experiments. Davis Bend, by the way, is an interesting place. That was where Jefferson Davis's plantations were. The Union Army confiscated them pretty early in the war. And so abolitionist generals started running experiments in free labor in these places. And we're mostly going to be looking at what happened at that point. So what were these experiments testing? Number one, they were testing whether civilization can progress without forced labor. And this could be broken down into a couple of questions. One is, would free labor prove to be more productive than slave labor, as Smith argued? And secondly, were slaves fit for freedom? That is, would they behave in a civilized manner upon emancipation? Which is to say, would they be industrious, self-improving, and law-abiding? Now, the slaves themselves, I think, had a different question that they wanted to ask about these free labor experiments, and that is, would what the Northerners were calling emancipation deliver anything close to real freedom for them? That was the question they were interested in. Now, I've highlighted some of these terms in red because they're hotly contested, normatively laden terms. And these are the ideas, the ideals that were being refined as the experiments were taking place. And this is a really critical pragmatist moment, is that ideals are never fixed. As we try to live them out, we keep on refining what we mean by them. And that's a very important idea. The critical issues at stake in really in all the post-emancipation societies was, okay, you've abolished slavery, but what kind of freedom would the former slaves actually enjoy? And there were conflicting views. The freed people, and in the United States, radical Republicans, shared with them the view that to be a truly free laborer is to be a yeoman farmer, or self-employed in some other sense. Right, to be a truly free laborer is to not have a boss, to be one's own boss, one's own master. That was the ideal of the Republican Party. That was the ideal that Lincoln explicitly advocated on the stump. That was the ideal of all the radical Republicans, and that was the ideal of all the freed people everywhere you could look, in Jamaica, Barbados, Haiti, the American South. That was the ideal that all the former slaves were aspiring to. If you couldn't be a yeoman farmer, the next best, at least in the American South, was to be a sharecropper. Okay, you wouldn't get to own your own land, but you would rent it. You would still have some autonomy, okay, deciding, you know, you wouldn't have any overseer with a whip or anything like that. You would farm your own individual family plot. And if you couldn't be a sharecropper, the worst outcome would be back on the plantation with pretty much the same style of labor as under slavery, with a gang and an overseer driving, you know, the laborers relentlessly. Okay? So the freed people and the radical Republicans, the really radical Republicans, wanted the freed people to own their own plot of land and just be independent farmers. But plantation gang labor, that's what the planters wanted. And many government policymakers also were interested in maintaining plantation gang labor as much as possible. This was certainly what the British government wanted. This was the model that they were seeking in places like Jamaica post-emancipation. They wanted labor to go on pretty much as it was before, except instead of the whip, the workers would be paid a wage, and they would have rights to family and things like that. Okay? So essentially, what the planters and what many government policymakers wanted was the condition that I've defined as minimal abolition. So what actually happened as a result of this experiment? I'm just going to give you one chart, okay, which is sugar production, because sugar was the one crop that was shared across all the post-emancipation societies. And so here we could see Smith predicted you free the workers, pay them a wage, they'd be even more productive than slave labor. That doesn't look good, right? Sugar production in Haiti dropped almost to nothing. Everywhere else, you look in Louisiana there, post-emancipation, right? They don't want to grow sugar. Right, Barbados, you had a slight increase. That was due to peculiar conditions. I'll tell you if you in the Q&A if you're interested in why Barbados was the rare exception. Okay, so was Smith wrong? In Britain, many policymakers looked at the drop-off in sugar production. They said this experiment is a failure. Okay. No doubt sugar production per worker was higher under slavery than under emancipation. And the reason for this was that no free worker was willing to work on the plantations at the extreme intensity and continuity that could be extracted from slaves under the whip. One Jamaican observer who actually tallied up the numbers calculated that under slavery, the slaves were forced to work 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whereas under emancipation, the freed people were only willing to work 6 hours a day, 4 days a week on the sugar plantations. So you can easily see you're going to get less sugar that way. Okay, so emancipation led to a condition in which people were putting out fewer total labor hours per free person. And in particular, women were withdrawing their labor from the fields. Secondly, wherever the freed people got the chance, they shifted from producing cash crops, the crops that were seen to be necessary for civilization, towards subsistence crops, okay, just for feeding themselves and their own families. Importantly, though, tropical staple production was not eliminated. There's still positive amounts of sugar being produced, and same for the other tropical crops, coffee, tobacco, rice, cotton, and so forth. It was reduced but not eliminated. Okay? So how do we interpret what went on? Well, the conservatives had one interpretation. Here I'll just take a very characteristic view from Sir Henry Taylor, who was head of the colonial office in Britain. He said, look, this data shows just what we've thought all along, that blacks have no desire for self-improvement. He insisted that the freed people had abandoned civilization for barbarism, right? They're just going back to subsistence living and had lapsed into idleness and sloth. Hence, he concluded, as many conservatives did, that Smith's view was refuted. Smith was just wrong, at least insofar as his hypothesis was applied to blacks and to tropical staple production. As you can imagine, the freed people had a very different interpretation of what was actually going on. And here I'll just quote Frederick Douglass. The first point he made was epistemological. Experience proves that it takes more than one class of people to tell the whole truth about matters in which they are interested on opposite sides. Right? Douglass here is articulating the fundamental pragmatist point that everybody's got their own biases, and in order to find out whether you're biased, you should consult people maybe who have different interests than you, and you'll come, you know, you'll get different views. So Douglass insisted, why don't you ask the freed people why they are withdrawing labor from the fields, okay? And indeed, his argument was that the trouble is not that the colored people are indolent, but that the system had pretty much been rigged against them so that no matter how hard they worked, they still had very little prospect for improving their condition. So again, Douglass here then is accusing the conservatives of falling into the fundamental attribution error of assuming that the withdrawal of labor is due to an innate disposition to laziness on the part of blacks, when in fact it's their circumstances, that the circumstances have been rigged in such a way that working harder doesn't really get them anything more. So now we should look back, and we have contemporary social science evidence and historical evidence. Why did the freed people reduce their levels of plantation labor? Well, the first reason why they did it and why they shifted to subsistence labor over cash cropping, they did that basically for sheer survival and also to provide for child welfare. In the colony of Saint-Domingue that became Haiti, there was a 5 to 10% annual death rate from overwork and malnutrition in the sugar plantations. Think about it. People were being worked to death, and indeed that was true across all the sugar colonies. The labor was unbelievably brutal, and they were also underfed. Indeed, slave owners would boast that it was cheaper just to work and starve the slaves to death and just import more from Africa than it was to enable them to have a normal lifespan. So in all the West Indian colonies, they could not sustain their population without constant imports. So here you can see some of the results after the Haitian Revolution. The slaves won their freedom. So here you see a population, 500,000 in 1790, before the slaves revolted. And remember, this population level was only sustained in virtue of constant imports from Africa. Okay? By 1823, remember, they consolidated their freedom in 1804. So we're talking about a generation later. The population has zoomed up. None of this is from imported labor from Africa. Finally, for the first time in the history of the country, they have a natural increase in population. They're actually growing enough to feed themselves and not working themselves to death. Right? Well, it would make sense, right? Nobody's going to work themselves to death if they can avoid it. In the United States, there was a natural increase in the slave population. But nevertheless, I still argue that even in the United States, we had somewhat below subsistence, but we can view this by looking at child mortality data. So here you can see just shocking levels of child mortality, especially at birth. Here we're just contrasting slave child mortality against the U.S. average, which is in blue. Okay, you see just shocking levels of child mortality. Why were the children dying off? Well, we have very good evidence why. It was because very shortly after giving birth, the mothers would be forced back to work in the fields. The children had almost no one to tend to them. It also meant that the infants were weaned very, very early and put onto solid food, which was not adequately nutritious. Okay, and so they're dying at very high rates. You see, eventually, by the time they reach their 20s, then the mortality rates would pretty much equalize. Okay, but childhood was just a terrible experience for the slaves. The second reason why the slaves withdrew their labor hours from the plantations was that wage labor was deliberately designed not to pay and offered the freed people very few prospects for improvement. The first phase of emancipation, all of these experiments that were being done in both in England and in the United States, really only practiced minimal abolition, and they retained effective bondage. That is, there was not any freedom to, say, choose one's employer and quit if one was unhappy with the employment conditions one's current employer was offering. In the Civil War experiments, wages were dictated rather than negotiated. Employers were free to take deductions or even just defraud the freed people. There's very little enforcement of payment. It's very inconsistent. The war also disrupted payments a lot, so you could easily imagine why the newly freed people were not so keen on working so hard. In Jamaica, what was instituted was a brief period known as apprenticeship, and then when that stopped, they were closer to free workers. But then economists went out and measured the wages, and they found out that even if you work full-time on the plantations, the wages were lower than subsistence. So naturally, they have to grow food on their own plots just in order to survive. And the third reason why the freed people withdrew labor from the plantations was the aspiration for autonomy. Okay, they shifted to other forms of work and self-improvement. They wanted to have control over their own time rather than working every last waking minute in the fields. They had better things to do with their time. And so here in the Port Royal experiment, there were Northerners who came down, many abolitionists from the Boston area, such as William Gannett and Laura Towne, famous abolitionists who set up a school to teach the freed people how to read and write and do arithmetic. And everyone observed that as far as schooling went, the Negroes will do anything for us if only we will teach them. They're extremely highly motivated by the desire to learn. That was a chief form of self-improvement that they aspired to. And it was lucky that they were setting up schools because the ability to pay wages during the Civil War was very constantly disrupted by wartime conditions. So I would argue that, as a matter of fact, Smith was mostly vindicated. And indeed, the Treasury Department agents and the Army agents that observed these early free labor experiments that were run by abolitionists and sometimes by the Army themselves, they universally observed that the freed people worked harder on their own account than on wages or on gang labor. That is, if they did have the chance to just farm on a plot of their own, they would be highly productive on that plot. They would work very, very hard. Secondly, it was universally observed by these agents that the freed people worked harder if they were paid more, if they were paid on time, if they were paid what they were promised. Makes sense, right? This is exactly what Smith said. And they also observed, and this is actually quite important, that conditions were actually, economic conditions and prices were changing very rapidly during this time. It turned out that truck farming, that is, growing things like vegetables and so forth, was actually yielding higher pay than plantation labor was. So it made sense that they would be shifting over to food crops instead of cotton. So indeed, I think the reality is, if we go back here, that Smith was largely right. The labor supply curve did rise above the level of subsistence, just as Smith predicted. It's just that his only error was he thought slavery maybe was around here with fewer labor hours than what the market wage would yield, when in fact slavery was right way out here, because the whip really was extracting more labor hours than people could endure, but of course it was below subsistence as well. People were dying, or their children were dying. So this brings us back to William Henry Brisbane, who returned to Port Royal, his hometown, to the very place where one of the most famous labor experiments, free labor experiments, was done during the Civil War. He returned as a U.S. tax commissioner. Okay, and why? What were the tax commissioners doing in Port Royal? Well, during this period, of course, no federal taxes were being paid in the South because it was in rebellion. And so he was put in charge of figuring out how they could get revenue. And he was put in charge, in particular, of the disposition of abandoned plantations. So this was a point of some dispute, because now we have choice. What is the model of free labor that the freed people were going to get? The freed people were quite clear what they wanted. They wanted 40 acres and a mule, right? They wanted their own individual plot of land that they could farm on their own. And indeed, in Port Royal, there was a movement to give small farms to the freed people, and a number of them did manage, before Brisbane showed up, to acquire legal title to small farms. Brisbane, though, he had a different idea entirely. Remember, he's the advocate of minimal abolition, which he got from a very strained interpretation of the Bible. Okay, so his idea was, no, we should keep the plantations intact and have the freed people work pretty much the same way they did as in slave times, only instead of being whipped, they would be paid a wage. Now, Laura Towne, she found this prospect appalling. She was a radical abolitionist. She had been working for years teaching the freed people how to read. Even though this photograph only shows children, the adults also were very keen, and so she was running a school for adults as well. And she complained about Brisbane, he and his fellow tax commissioner. She said, they're forcing men to prove they're fit to be free by holding a tyrant's power over them. And she was complaining here, Brisbane's coming in saying, well, they got to prove that they're fit for freedom, and they're going to do that by being wage laborers on intact plantations. Whereas Laura Towne, along with the freed people themselves, said, no, just give us our own plot of land and we can handle ourselves and prove ourselves fit for freedom by being independent farmers. So, in fact, what happened was that the American experiment ended up being limited but not entirely reversed. There was a great struggle that ensued between the freed people who wanted to be yeoman farmers and people like Brisbane and other government policymakers who wanted to pretty much retain the plantations intact and the gang labor system. Okay? And the result of this struggle was a middle position, namely sharecropping. That's mainly what resulted across the South. So there was a kind of compromise between those views. And how did that happen? Basically, just a little elementary economics here. The freed people, recall, withdrew a lot of labor hours from the plantation. They just refused to do it. That has the same effect as a general strike. Some of the freed people had organized at this point and actually were going on official strikes. But even without that, the truth is that individually they had overwhelming reasons to withdraw labor hours from the field so they could do things like make sure their children survived and so they could have time to like learn how to read and things like that. So even if they hadn't organized, it's still the case that they withdrew their labor hours. And of course, when a supply of labor shifts to the left, right, the wage goes up, right, standard economics. And so, lo and behold, they obtained what a better position for themselves, namely sharecropping. That is, they took some of their wage in a non-pecuniary form, namely in a change in the terms of conditions of labor other than the wage itself, because sharecropping was much preferred to gang labor. So now let's go back and think about what pragmatism can learn from this. Pragmatism says, first of all, that if we're going to test whether a practical norm makes sense, we should first explore the problem that the norm is supposed to solve and test alternative solutions to that problem. And the second thing pragmatism tells us to do is to mobilize those who've been excluded from inquiry, moral inquiry, practical inquiry, mobilize them to start participating in practical inquiry in order to counter the biases of the powerful people who've pretty much designed the practical norms to serve their own interests. Okay? And we can see that this happened to a certain degree in these early free labor experiments. We have an incremental correction of objectification bias in the United States. Okay, so remember what the objectification bias was against blacks. Blacks were viewed as good for menial labor and cash crops. That view was enforced by limiting abolition to its minimal form in the very early stages. And whites represented blacks as inherently fit for gang labor and unfit for any degree of labor autonomy. Pragmatists say mobilize the people who haven't had an opportunity to shape these moral beliefs. Okay, what do? Well, the freed people contested minimal abolition very actively, sometimes by going on strike, sometimes by individually withholding their labor from plantations, refusing to sign gang labor contracts. Okay, and by contesting that limit, they won a limited autonomy in the sharecropping regime. I have to stress, it was still a very limited autonomy, but it was way better than gang labor. And they proved, in fact, in the American case, cotton production actually increased under sharecropping for a variety of complicated reasons. They showed that sharecropping, that is offering greater autonomy to the freed people, would enable higher productivity, and that forced a kind of concession, a limited concession from whites, that at least blacks were fit for this limited kind of autonomy, that they were not inherently capable of only gang labor. Okay, so we have an incremental correction, not a complete concession, but an incremental correction of objectification bias. So what was learned from these very early free labor experiments? Firstly, the rationale for slavery was undermined. What was discovered was, in no case was tropical cash crop production brought down to zero. Okay, it dropped, but civilization was never at stake in the abolition of slavery. That's ultimately what people concluded. The only thing that was at stake was how much you had to pay for the staples in question. Okay, so production goes down, so they have to pay more for sugar, for coffee, for rice, and so forth. Not a big deal. Civilization can handle that. Secondly, and more slowly, what the free labor experiments did was reshape ideals of civilization and freedom. So remember, it's another great theme that pragmatist testing of practical norms never keeps the goalposts fixed. It's never just a purely instrumental test. It's partly instrumental, but as we're living in accordance with some ideal, we're constantly adjusting it in certain ways as we gain experience with that ideal. And ultimately, this was took a longer argument, but ultimately people came to recognize that a civilization in which everyone could enjoy its benefits is better than one in which some people are gratuitously denied access to the benefits of civilization as the slaves were. It's an interesting argument that actually John Stuart Mill made to that effect. And a second thing was that people came to understand that freedom had to mean something more than minimal abolition. It had to mean something more than just replacing the whip with the wage. That freedom in the context of labor had to include some level of self-direction or autonomy. So what can we learn today from these experiments in living? Well, as we can see from Brisbane's case, we shouldn't rely too heavily on a priori moral reasoning. Okay, Brisbane did it, but his reasoning wasn't all that reliable. It's subject to biases, and it's likely to neglect the interests of those who are not participating in moral inquiry. I think Dewey had a better idea about how to achieve more reliable moral inquiry. It should enlist the participation of everybody involved. It should contest biases in action, not just in argument. It's one thing to be around a seminar table and have these abstract arguments. It's another thing to contest the arguments on the ground in fighting over the actual constitution of a labor regime. And more reliable moral inquiry tests moral norms in experience. It's very important. Philosophers are used to testing moral norms in thought experiments, right? We imagine some scenario and we think about, well, how, you know, what is my moral reaction to, you know, version 23 of the trolley problem or something. And pragmatists say, you know, you can learn something from that, but you can learn even more through an experiment in living by actually consulting how actual people confronted with the real problems respond and what they learn from the real consequences, not just the imagined consequences of acting in accordance with one norm or another. And so I suggest to you that pragmatism has enduring lessons and offers us a useful way to update our moral beliefs. Thank you.
Yes. So you gave reasons for aligning the number of labor hours and jobs after slavery, but the job is pretty precipitous. Do you have any opinion on what the reason for dropping so dramatic?
Okay, so yeah, so this gets to the actual conditions of sugar production in particular, because the really precipitous drop was with sugar production. Here's some relevant facts about sugar. Sugar was the first industrial process, a truly industrial product of the Industrial Revolution. And the difficulty with sugar is that as soon as the canes ripen in the field, you have 24 hours to cut it and process it, or else it ferments, and then it's no good. So we're talking about when harvest time comes, it's 24/7 grueling labor. Unbelievably harsh, brutal, grueling labor, not just cutting the cane, but then it's a highly industrial process. You had these gigantic boilers, you had these cane crushers, and the cane crushers were these crude devices. You're sticking the cane in, and if a fingertip entered those rollers, pretty soon your whole arm, and you would be crushed. Imagine these exhausted workers being whipped 24/7. They're dropping from exhaustion. It's so hot. It's hot in the fields. It's hot because of these gigantic boilers. People are fatigued. They're overworked. They don't have enough time to sleep and eat. And they're getting crushed in the rollers. Or with the machetes, they're cutting like mad, and they're accidentally slicing off fingers and so forth. Enormous rates of accidents. It's just, I guarantee you, you saw the freed people, they're working 6 hours a day. I don't think a single one of us would last an hour in harvest time. Not one of us. Okay, that's why they withdrew their labor. It was deadly. Right. Well, the reason for the sugar drop-off in Haiti actually was that the freed people just refused to do it. So it's true that there were external factors, but in fact, there was a brief period of time. And this is a very important thing about post-emancipation societies. Not a single one of these societies instituted anything that we would consider truly free labor today. And that was equally true in Haiti. They tried to restore, and for a few years they did restore, plantation-style gang labor and brought the numbers back up. But the freed people, they just didn't want that. Sugar was the last thing they wanted. It was a death trap. And they just said no. And in Haiti also, it was a place where they were able to successfully establish peasant agriculture, every farmer on their own independent plot. And that, to this day, really is characteristic of the Haitian agroeconomy. That quest for autonomy was completely overriding. The biggest thing was to get rid of the master, the overseer. Autonomy, I think, just overrode everything in Haiti, and they managed to achieve that. Jamaica, you had some portion of the population achieved autonomous, independent farming. So they tended to mix independent farming with work, supplementary wages on the plantations, which still lasted a long time. In the United States, because the freed people didn't get independent access to land, in fact, that was the highest priority of the planter class after the war, was to rig the whole system so that blacks couldn't get independent access to the land. So that's why they sharecropping ended up being the equilibrium position. Yeah. So let's think about thought experiments. Now, pragmatists have no problem in general with thought experiments. Look, all deliberation is a thought experiment. Practical deliberation, right? What do? You think, well, maybe I should do this, and then you anticipate what the consequences would be, and then you anticipate what your reaction. Are you going to be happy with those consequences or not happy? Right? And the great virtue of thought experiments is that it's costly to do the real experiment, right? And you can test out a bunch of alternatives in thinking, whereas in reality, right, you're going to be committed to one. Of course, you could have different experiments run by different people, but any one person is limited in the number of experiments they can run. So pragmatists don't have a problem, right? Deliberation is just another kind of thought experiment that we take place. The point is that deliberation is often wrong, right? That is, the experiment you run in your head, you're often surprised, right? You think this is going to be really great, and then you put it into practice and you realize, uh-oh, didn't anticipate this or that problem. Or you might have even anticipated the consequences, but you didn't anticipate accurately your emotional reaction. That is, you think, wow, I'm going to get married to the greatest person. And then you actually do marry, and uh-oh, right? It could be emotional letdown, right? These things happen all the time. And so what pragmatists say, it's not that thought experiments are inherently bad. We have to do them. It's just that you learn a lot more from the real experiment. And consequently, when we're doing moral philosophy, you don't get rid of thought experiments, but you also think very carefully about the real ways people are behaving and what we can learn from things like history, from social science. It can tell us a lot more than just sticking to ideas in our heads. Right, and so what this means is no particular experiment is decisive. And no particular experiment can be guaranteed to have corrected all the moral biases and other cognitive biases that are in our heads. That's why pragmatists think that moral progress is incremental, right? We never get to an ultimate, full, completely justified system of moral beliefs. The best we can hope for is incremental improvement on the beliefs we started with. Fully aware that the beliefs we start with probably contain lots of errors and biases in them. And we can make incremental corrections. And you're quite right. Look, we look back at sharecropping today and we think that, correctly, by the way, that wasn't really, it was sort of free, but it wasn't really free labor, right? I mean, it was better than slavery, absolutely better than slavery. But far from anything we today would consider genuinely free organization of labor. What I'm showing here is that a little bit of moral learning took place. Our notion of what freedom entailed expanded a little bit in this period, but it took even more contestation and even more experimentation to arrive at a more free and satisfactory way of organizing labor. And that's a really long history, and in fact, we're still dealing with some of these issues today. Yeah. So I actually would disagree with you that a priori moral reasoning can show that liberty is more important than money. I think it's much more complicated. For one thing, you have to ask, you know, what actually is the standard of living of people at the time? I mean, is liberty better than, you know, liberty? Suppose you're starving, right? There's going to be some limit at which maybe sacrifice of liberty is going to be worth money. So what we do have today, right, we've reached certain solutions to problems of production such that we understand now that we don't need to make sacrifices of fundamental liberty in order to achieve subsistence and even a decent standard of living for everybody. Okay, but that's something that we learned in practice. Back at the time that slavery was considered an active option, people really were genuinely afraid that if workers weren't forced to work, civilization would just collapse. And we'd all be, you know, just rooting around. Really, that's what people thought. And even if it wasn't as extreme as slavery, the truth is that even the workers who were called free in the mid-18th century were not at all free by contemporary standards. Just to give you a few examples. Free workers. There were anti-enticement laws. That meant it was against the law for a competing employer to offer higher wages to someone already under contract. Okay, so there's no competition among employers. Is that free? Take another point. Unemployment was a crime. It was called vagrancy. You could be thrown in jail for being unemployed, for quitting your employer. You could be thrown in jail. And what was the punishment? Penal servitude. Okay, so I could give you many more examples of how the conditions of labor, even deep into the 19th century, were even of free laborers, even in the North in the United States, would not be considered free by today's standards. So the acquisition of a very robust notion of liberty was something that was hard fought and hard tested in experience. And people didn't even have much of a concept of what free labor really meant until they had created it on the ground.
But I'm still not clear on how the testing of the moral norms is supposed to go. So it seems like I can use experiments like these to show that some empirical beliefs that lead to other moral beliefs, these derived moral beliefs from the moral principles, I can show those empirical beliefs are false, and then end up revising the moral beliefs that depend on them. But I'm not clear on how it could be the provision of fundamental beliefs. And this connects with the thought that we're going to see that there's a problem and then we're going to see how to solve it. And solving problems can sometimes doing wrong things can solve problems. Being efficient, right? Being probably right or part. So I'm not clear on that.
Okay, so let's take the second one first. remember, we're enlisting everybody in participating in moral inquiry. And one of the things, one of the implications of that is that you can contest people's understanding of what the problem is. And so, yeah, sure, you could have an efficient regime. Slavery was efficient in a sense that excluded the interests of the slaves themselves. And in fact, this was a point that was raised by John Stuart Mill in a famous argument he had with Thomas Carlyle, a noted conservative who wrote a notorious essay, Thoughts on the Negro Question, which he published after abolition was achieved in England. And he was upset that sugar production had dropped in Jamaica. And he gave the same argument that conservatives were making. It just proves that blacks are not fit for freedom, they're indolent, they're just letting pumpkins grow in Jamaica, and they work 15 minutes a day just picking the pumpkins and eating it. This is the idea. And he, in fact, it's, of course, not remotely true. But Mill wrote a very famous essay in response to Carlyle, in which he said, look, Carlyle's talking about how you had to force people. Carlyle was basically arguing for lifelong bonded labor in order to get cash crop production back up to its former levels. And because that was the foundation of civilization. That's Carlyle's argument. He's doing it even after abolition. And Mill says, what are we talking about civilization here? Right? How could producing more sugar possibly be worth the grueling labor and death and destruction of millions of people? How could you call that civilization? You know, civilization has to be something that is inclusive of the interests of everyone. If someone is working to produce the fruits of civilization, surely they deserve to enjoy a share of those fruits themselves. Isn't it more civilized to create a society in which everyone can enjoy its fruits, among which include things like everyone having a chance for an education? A very critical point that the freed people in the United States were after, right? Give us time to study so we could learn to read and write. Isn't that part of civilization? How could it be more civilized when a huge portion of the population is prevented from acquiring literacy? Surely some drop in tropical and subtropical cash crop production is worth increased literacy and ability to, like, raise your kids, things like that. And Mill ultimately won the day, but what he did here is he's subtly shifting our understanding of what civilization involves. It's a really complicated, messy concept with lots of working parts. And that's why I keep on pointing out that these ideals, these normative ideals we're working with, they're changing as we acquire new knowledge of what's possible. And of course, this was very critical during the Industrial Revolution because productive capacities are expanding. And the ability to do things like achieve universal education. You know, universal literacy would have been impossible in the Middle Ages. Simply the economy couldn't sustain enough teachers. By the mid-19th century, that was possible in Jamaica as well as in the United States. And once you see that's possible, it's pretty hard to argue that civilization means a whole giant portion of the population shouldn't have access to literacy when it's perfectly possible to give it to them at the mere cost of paying a little bit more for the sugar in your tea. No, that's quite right.
Okay.
But I didn't claim that. Yeah.
I think the model sort of suggests that. Here's another model.
Yeah.
It might be Marxist or it might be Marxist.
Yeah.
Right? It's not that there's an epistemic problem in the upper classes, in the classes who benefit from the forced labor display. There's a material benefit. And that gives them a bias of a different sort. It gives them an interest in certain things not being true. It's much better. Right. Okay. So yeah. So two points. One is that objectification bias, of course, is a deeply interested bias. So when I talk about cognitive bias, I don't mean that it's all cool in the sense of not motivated. There's enormous amounts of motivation involved. But I do think that the ideology was really deeply held. I mean, these were true believers. You read these pro-slavery people, they really believed everything they were saying. So it's not just sort of ideology in the sense of a smokescreen that manipulators are pouring over everybody else. It's like they're taking it in themselves. They're fooling themselves. And it is deeply interested. Objectification bias is a very deeply interested kind of cognitive bias. So I do definitely part ways with some cognitive psychologists who think it's like just all tricks in the brain and stuff, like very cool and not motivated. Tricks in the brain, you know, so some cognitive psychologists think, for instance, that's, you know, stereotyping is a completely generic, uninterested mechanism, cognitive mechanism. Okay.
Well, you know, you have cool biases and hot biases, and I'm perfectly happy to say a lot of these biases are deeply interested. The second thing about what the slaves were thinking, this I think is a really complicated question. If you read a lot of the abolitionist literature written by free blacks, they actually complain about how the brutalization of the slaves has demoralized them and sort of just undermined their own self-esteem and their own sense of pride and personal capacity and personal efficacy. So I'm not so sure that we could say slaves knew that they were oppressed. There's no doubt about that. Slaves everywhere have never been under any confusion that they were oppressed. Okay, but to have a full sense of oneself as an efficacious individual who's capable of full autonomy, at least according to a lot of free blacks, abolitionists up north, they were very afraid that a lot of the slaves had internalized oppression. It would take a lot of work to get them out of that. Yeah, yeah.